So finally, we're getting to our keynote speaker, and I have to say that I am incredibly honored to be able to introduce Dr. Jim Curran, if I can call you by Jim. I've known Jim for quite some time and even had some many discussions over the breakfast table at my house when Jim was visiting about what we should be doing about HIV and STD prevention in this country. That was almost 20 years ago. If you don't know Dr. Curran, he, since 1995, was appointed as professor of epidemiology and now is an endowed dean of the Rowland School of Public Health at Emory University. He graduated from the University of Notre Dame. He received his MD from the University of Michigan, a Master's of Public Health from Harvard. And probably most importantly, he was one of the first people involved with the HIV epidemic. In 1981, he coordinated the task force on Kaposi's sarcoma and acquired immune deficiency syndrome at the Centers for Disease Control. So he has been a phenomenal national and international leader in the field of HIV prevention. He actually led the HIV/AIDS division at CDC for a number of years before he moved over into more academic circles. I'm not going to list the long list of honors and exceptional service that he has provided to the field of public health, especially in the field of HIV. But I also just want to remind everyone where he got his roots started. His first job in 1971 was a clinical research investigator at the VD branch in the CDC. And actually, a few years later, he moved to be the clinical research investigator of the operations research branch. And we just spent an entire day talking about program science, so the connections are very strong. He was elected to the IOM in 1993 and has over 260 publications in peer-reviewed journals, both in the field of STD prevention as well as contributions to HIV. So I think as we embrace the theme of this conference of looking for innovations and new ways that we can move forward, I think it's always important that we reflect from the past of what we've learned previously, and I think we are very lucky we could not have a better speaker today to really talk to us about reflections from the AIDS era and share with us your sort of personal journey and important words that we need to consider as we move forward. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the still new but very experienced and distinguished Dr. Boland for the introduction. And happy birthday, Lynn. It's interesting that you're the same age as Merrill Lynch. Watch out for Bank of America. It could be coming. It's really an honor to be back here at the National STD Conference. It brings back lots of memories, and I'm so blessed that I have a memory. But I gave my first professional presentation in 1972 at the National STD Conference in Houston. I was very nervous. I was talking about the costs of the complications of gonorrhea and how I was going to try to figure out what they were to a group of people at the large National STD Conference in Houston at that time. And it's interesting to me to reflect back on those 40 years. One reflection I have is that I was born between 1935 and 1960. Some of you... That's my lack of specificity goes to becoming going from being an epidemiologist and very reductionistic to being a dean when everything's kind of vague. Many of you, some of you, a couple of you, may have been born between 1935 and 1960. And if you were, that means that you were a group of people who both, and a group of only the only people in the entire world, actually, who were born between and started having sex and started your professional careers in the interlude between the fatal fatal syphilis, incurable syphilis, and the incurable fatal AIDS era, an era that I'm going to refer to as the interlude in between here. And, you know, we're the only generation that was. All of the rest of the history of the world had fatal syphilis and fatal STDs. And then beginning somewhat after 1960, everybody had fatal AIDS. So we're just a really select little group of people that started our careers and started having sex during that era. Now, I'm going to be, Gail already told you I started off as a medical officer with the VD branch, trained by the very young Dr. King Holmes. I received a couple lectures from him, fresh from his Subic Bay studies. What I'm not going to do is I'm not going to try to summarize all of the terrific scientific and programmatic contributions that have been made in the last 40 years, nor am I ever even going to marvel at them in the terms of diagnostics, therapeutics, vaccines. And I'm not going to compare and contrast HIV with STDs, nor am I going to imply that the changes that have occurred in the last 40 years are either causally related to AIDS or merely just temporally related. But instead, I'm merely going to give you some selected, unbiased reflections. And I can testify that they will be unbiased because I've recently read a book that I've inspired me called An Unbiased History of the Civil War, A Southern Perspective. So I want to start with some selected dates. The first U.S. Public Health Service funding for venereal disease began in 1919. Undoubtedly, much of the responsibility was from the lobbying and advocacy of King Holmes. In the 1930s, the Surgeon General Perrin, now think about this, the Surgeon General made syphilis control the U.S. Public Health Service priority, and much of the U.S. Public Health Service funding was for syphilis control. Part of this was an inspiration from his book, Shadow on the Land, and that book itself was courageous advocacy from the head of the Public Health Service during a much more conservative time with a much more conservative government and population. And this book and his leadership inspired many of us, both publicly and privately, as we thought about advocacy early in the AIDS game, both in and outside of government. Unfortunately, during this time of largesse for the syphilis control in the Public Health Service, during a time of excess, if you will, the Public Health Service and my own historical VD branch began the Tuskegee study in rural Alabama, which became a shadow on the U.S. Public Health Service. World War II kept the heat going. Now we've all seen the posters today and in the archives for those posters. Venereal diseases impeded the war effort, and that kept the funding going and kept the concerns going. Unfortunately, during that time of largesse also, my own group, the U.S. Public Health Service and the old VDRL, began studies with prisoners in Terre Haute, Indiana, which were stopped because they were thought to be publicly unpopular and replaced with the Guatemala experiments that was not only Dr. Cutler, but the entire VDRL's sponsorship. And it really hurt me to see my hero, Dr. Thomas Perrin, had been given approval for these experiments. It hurt me quite a bit. Also at that time, antibiotics came along and really changed the face of susceptible sexually transmitted or venereal diseases. And the VDRL and the malaria control groups joined together with some other small functions to form the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta in 1946. The interlude period, what I'm calling the 1950s to 1980s at the CDC, occurred with a main diminution of funding for VD control, and almost all of the funds were for syphilis control. During this period, there were really only five official venereal diseases. Syphilis, gonorrhea, and three more that nobody had ever heard of or would ever see: chancroid, granuloma inguinale, and lymphogranuloma venereum. I still have only seen three of those five. Priority number one for the CDC in the 50s and 1970s was syphilis control. Priority number two was syphilis control And priority number 3, 4, and 5 were syphilis control. The term epidemiology in Atlanta was defined as syphilis contact tracing. We are epidemiologists, meaning we are syphilis contact tracers. So in 1971, I joined a group of 6 dermatologists who had been syphilologists as the only non-dermatologist on the staff who didn't know what I was doing, but I was joined there, trained briefly to work on their new gonorrhea control program with a $6 million budget to try to estimate the costs of STDs. Unfortunately, they gave me my first podium in Houston in 1972 and an interest in the health of populations, and I changed my own career to public health and to CDC. During that interlude, some of you and many others broadened the definition of venereal diseases to include STDs, and that recognized the importance of chlamydia, herpes simplex virus, hepatitis B virus, cervical cancer, and enteric pathogens. But the funding remained low and the advocacy low and the stigma remained very, very high. And the work with communities was just beginning. In 1970s, 70% of the syphilis in the United States was in gay men. And it wasn't their highest priority, although it was the number 1, 2, and 3 priority of the CDC. The highest STD priority for gay men was hepatitis B. And fortunately, the VD branch worked with the hepatitis division in studying hepatitis B and in hepatitis B vaccine trials. But there was still little money. I borrowed this slide from John Douglas, which kind of looks at mortality from syphilis and AIDS from 1900 to 1996. And you can see that the first half of the century, there were enormous rates of mortality for syphilis to be vanquished by penicillin and to enter in the interlude before the enormous mortality began for AIDS. Now, we were fortunate at the time in 1978 when I came to Atlanta as chief of the operations research branch. Bill Darrow was the only doctorally trained social scientist at the CDC. And he had the wisdom to double the number by hiring Dr. Sevki Aral at the time. There were 2 national STD conferences in 1981 when the first 5 cases of pneumocystis pneumonia were reported from Los Angeles in gay men. Unfortunately, Harold Jaffe and Bill Darrow and I and others could attend those conferences and talk to your counterparts in those days about whether they were seeing the same things among gay men or others. And our work in the hepatitis B vaccine trials provided other contacts in the gay community to find out that these cases were indeed occurring in other areas. This was also the Reagan administration, and funding was cut. There was essentially no travel money, and there was a real cutback in domestic programs to go along with double-digit unemployment and high inflation. But CDC likes to jump on new problems, and many people at the CDC, including many from the STD era, Drs. Jaffe, Darrow, Guinan, Rushing, Monroe, and others, joined and we formed a task force on Kaposi's sarcoma and opportunistic infections. This is just a picture from those days to show you 2 things. One is that myself and Dr. Darrow, Dr. Jaffe, Dr. Guinan, Dr. Spira, and Dr. Juranic were young once. And we were clearly visionary. The first thing we did was to establish a case definition for what we were going to study. And at the time, the only way to diagnose pneumocystis pneumonia was with an open lung biopsy. So you had to be pretty sick to warrant that. And the diagnosis was a biopsy-proven Kaposi sarcoma in people under 60, since almost all cases, and they were very rare, occurred in elderly men. or a biopsy, a culture-proven life-threatening or opportunistic infection with no possible underlying illness or history of immune suppression. The most important thing for us was that this would be a highly specific definition, since we didn't know whether it was new, who was getting it, and where it occurred. So we sacrificed sensitivity in order to establish the epidemiologic patterns. And this definition was rapidly picked up not only by state and local health departments, but by virtually every country in the world. But it was known to lack sensitivity, and we started to distribute iceberg slides to show that there were many people who might be involved who didn't fit the case definition. Our first peer-reviewed article came in the first week of 1982 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and you'll notice here that about 50% of the first 159 cases were cases of Kaposi's sarcoma, 40% were pneumocystis pneumonia, but 10% had both. Now, there were 158 cases in men and one case in a woman. And they were clearly, since this is occurring at the time of onset of illness, there was a clear pattern upward showing that the cases were increasing. This is the diagnosis of onset of illness. And secondly, cases were only occurring in 10 states, with 75% of the cases in California and New York. So most of the country and most of the world had not experienced this personally. And the doctors who were seeing Kaposi's sarcoma were either dermatologists or oncologists, and those with pneumocystis were infectious disease docs. But because 10% of the patients had both, that is about 15 people, we felt that it was important to say this was one epidemic, an epidemic of immune suppression, not of either cancer or infections. And then these are the icebergs. I think we distributed 30 or 40,000 of these back in the 35-millimeter slides. But there were gay men and others who had lymphadenopathy syndrome, immune thrombocytopenic purpura, a variety of other cancers, and other conditions that may or may not have been related to this, but we thought it was a much bigger group. Now, what we hoped from our experience in hepatitis B is that because the epidemiologic pattern looked like hepatitis B, we hoped that the cause, which we all thought was going to be a virus, would be a virus like hepatitis B, and that the bottom of the iceberg would be a form thrust, that there would be thousands of people who would be infected and who would develop antibody to this. Perhaps the lymphadenopathy syndrome was an example of that, and that we would then merrily go on and develop a vaccine, that this iceberg would represent the good cases, not simply the impending cases. Dr. Harold Jaffe and many colleagues in New York and California did a national case control study in which we matched gay men with either Kaposi's sarcoma or pneumocystis with age, race, and city-matched controls from STD clinics and private physicians' offices. Now, we knew that these cases were going to be overmatched for sexual behavior because the main reason people went to physicians' offices in the 1970s and 1980s was for STDs if they were openly gay men. And, of course, people in STD clinics went for STDs. So we thought that they would be more sexually active. But, in fact, the differentiator between the controls and the cases were all sexual behavior variables, larger numbers of lifetime and recent sexual partners, more sexual partners in bathhouses, and higher rates of antibody to other STDs in addition to this. And, of course, it was overmatched in another way because a number of the controls themselves ultimately had HIV. But we felt this pointed to sexual lifestyle as an important variable. Dr. Dave Auerbach was an EIS officer in Los Angeles, and he called Bill Darrow one day and said, a man had come into my office, and he said, he broke down in tears and said, here's a picture of my lover who just died of pneumocystis. He was a former bodybuilder and a handsome man who had wasted away to nothing. And he said, we went to a fundraiser in the gay community with nearly 1,000 people, and we sat at a table in 1978 and met 8 other people. And we got to be friends with these people, and eventually we partied with them and we had sex with them. and three of the people at this table have subsequently died. Now, this is three of the first 19 cases in Los Angeles. So Dr. Darrow and Dr. Auerbach went and talked to 13 of the 19 cases, the first 19, the 13 that were alive, and they found that 9 of these 13 cases in Metro Los Angeles had had sexual contact with another case in the United States within the past 5 years. And they took the investigation to interview 90 cases in the United States in gay men. At the time, 75% of the cases reported in the entire country. And they found that 40 of these 90 men, unbeknownst to each other and themselves, had had sexual contact with another case in 10 cities and 7 states within the previous 5 years. Now, the chance, if 5 to 10% of men in the United States are gay, the chance of this occurring by chance would be 1 times 10 to the minus 12. But people still didn't believe that this was caused by sexually transmitted organism because denial is very, very, very strong and other hypotheses abounded. Now, we know a couple other things, I think, in retrospect. It's very likely that the first cases of anything in any epidemic represent the people with the most exposures. In the early to mid-1970s, undoubtedly it was not easy to contract HIV because most people were not infected. So it took larger numbers of sexual partners. In addition, the people who got AIDS initially were probably the people with the highest viral loads and the shortest incubation periods. And it allowed us then to find people who had sexual contact within the previous 5 years only, because they also must have had short incubation periods. But we didn't know that then, and people were not convinced that this was caused by a virus. They weren't convinced until there were 3 cases reported in young men with hemophilia A. Dr. Dale Lawrence at CDC went and spent 2 weeks with each of the 2 patients who were living, and he determined to the best he could that these people had no other risk factors. One, I think, was the first case in Indiana, and another was a case in a young boy elsewhere. The only thing they could have had was exposure to blood through clotting factor concentrates. And indeed, we had several cases of what we thought was transfusion-associated AIDS reported to us at CDC, but had not been able to break the barrier in the blood banks to investigate the cases. Now, to remind us all, hemophilia A and hemophilia B are gender-linked genetic clotting disorders. They occur in about 25,000 Americans. Most of them, about two-thirds of them, are clearly genetically linked, and some are spontaneous mutations. Hemophilia A is a deficiency of clotting factor 8, and B a deficiency of clotting factor 9. And until the late 1960s, there was essentially no way around a permanent disability for hemophilia and early death, often due to hemorrhage, often strokes. But little boys would bump their knees and be permanently crippled. They'd run to their hematologist and get cryoprecipitate, often too late to stop the bleeding. But in the 1970s, a breakthrough occurred to have a concentrated factor 8 and factor 9 freeze-dried and put into lots and be given prophylactically to persons with hemophilia. Now, the FDA said in order to guard against new infections and have perhaps antibody, you must have at least 1,000 donors per lot. And most recipients would receive about 10 lots per year. They'd take clotting factor 8 and clotting factor 9 prophylactically. So they'd always have it around in their blood if they bumped their knees. And, of course, it increased their improved their lifestyle enormously. Hospitalizations went down from an average of 20 days a year to about 2 days per year, and they lived much, much longer. They could come to a conference like this, stick the Lyophilized stuff in their briefcase, reconstitute it with sterile water, and give presentations. And they did. They went to law school and medical school. But they also got hepatitis B and hepatitis non-A, non-B at the time. And they had liver disease. But that was a small price to pay for their freedom. And, of course, the clotting factors were not concentrated. So somebody receiving 250,000 donor blood per year is a perfect storm the promiscuity of blood, if you will, to get the new virus. And as soon as people saw this, they said it must be transmitted by a virus. Now, about the same time, the first cases of heterosexual transmission were reported from New York, from the Bronx, among women who were sex partners of drug users who themselves had AIDS or were immunocompromised. The first cases in infants from New York and California, again, often denied by some experts in immunology, but were shown to be born to women with this. First cases of lymphadenopathy syndrome, and the first cases of clear transfusion-associated AIDS. I'll come back to that, but we at CDC investigated 25 cases of transfusion-associated AIDS, in which case there would be one donor found many years earlier who had been a gay man who was immunocompromised, shown to have immune function. And this was a highly significant finding. So at the time, we changed the name of our task force, thank God, from Kaposi Sarcoma and Opportunistic Infections to the CDC Task Force on AIDS. And the CDC issued in October 1982 precautions for clinical and laboratory staff. People in hospitals were afraid to take care of AIDS patients, and people in laboratories were afraid to receive specimens. So the guidelines were very much like the guidelines for hepatitis B precautions. And in March of 1983, there were interagency recommendations on prevention of AIDS issued by the CDC and adopted by the gay community, the blood banks, the Red Cross, the American Medical Association, and many others. And these are the recommendations. First of all, sexual contact should be avoided with persons known or suspected to have AIDS. Members of what we then call high-risk groups should be aware that multiple sexual partners increase the probability of developing AIDS. And as a temporary measure, they should be refrained from donating plasma or blood. And in fact, the screening procedures for this decrease the transmission in the blood supply by 75% before antibody testing was even developed. And finally, there should be studies on other screening procedures for their effectiveness. At the time, core antibody to hepatitis C was being looked at. Fortunately, several months later, Drs. Barre, Sanous, and Montagnier from the Institut Pasteur published a paper in Science identifying lymphadenopathy virus as causal of lymphadenopathy syndrome in Paris. Dr. Gallo and his colleagues the next year published papers in Science on HTLV-3, and then there was a dispute that lasted longer than the period to discover the virus, in which HIV was the consensus name for the virus. It turned out that LAV was not only genetically similar, but was actually the same isolate as HIV, as HTLV-3. And the Nobel Prize in 2007 went to Barre, Sanous, and Dr. Montagnier for the discovery of HIV. So that gave us the opportunity at the CDC to test the thousands of specimens we'd collected in our epidemiologic studies. And our excitement lasted a very short period of time, because the two things I'm going to show you were among the most depressing and important findings from our studies. First of all, I already mentioned that we had published an article in the New England Journal with transfusion-associated AIDS, in which each case of AIDS, usually men, usually people who had multiple transfusions for bypass surgery, could be linked to a single donor many years earlier who was a gay man with or without lymphadenopathy, who was asymptomatic and remained asymptomatic many years later when we drew their blood and interviewed them. Well, Dr. Paul Fiorino in our labs went back and he isolated the virus many years after the donation from 90% of these men with crude isolation techniques. That meant to us that the positive antibody tests from years before meant that they were infected then, that most of them remained asymptomatic many years later, and they still had the virus. That means that the damn iceberg was filled up with people who retained infection, perhaps for life. That there wasn't going to be a form for us. There wasn't going to be hepatitis B and an easy vaccine. Once infected, always infected. And the mantra that people said is, well, you just have the antibody, you don't have the virus, wasn't true. When you have the antibody, you have the virus. You're infected with HIV. Then Dr. Jaffe and his colleagues, following work that had been done in the hepatitis studies, looked at a cohort that we had worked with in San Francisco Health Department, on hepatitis B epidemiology. Now, about 7,000 men were tested for hepatitis B and then followed over time in preparation for hepatitis B vaccine studies. And they gave us permission to test their blood retrospectively for HIV. And this is the second depressing finding. First of all, if you look at the left, you'll look at, you remember the first cases were reported in L.A. in 1981. You look at the right, you have the number of cases by 1984 among the 7,000 men. So by 1984, there were 27 cases of 7,000. In 1981, when those first five cases were reported, there were four cases of AIDS in this group. But the left, the seropositive slide, shows that by 1981, already 37% of these 7,000 gay men in San Francisco were infected with HIV, and by 1984, 67% of a group somewhat representative of the gay community in San Francisco. So that means if you extrapolate from those first five cases, that means that there were 250,000 gay men infected with HIV in the U.S. by the time those first five cases were reported. And by 1984, by the time the antibody test was available, by the time anybody could ever be tested for this virus, there were already 500,000 gay men in the United States infected. This is what I call the community incubation period. The dirty truth is that just as an individual who gets infected and then doesn't get sick for 10 years, so also a community becomes infected. And it doesn't become apparent for many, many years, until the epidemic is so, so serious. Most of these 500,000 men now have passed on. Now, Dr. Morgan, who was kind of one of the first modelers in our crude attempts at modeling in those days, could take this information from the San Francisco cohort, the natural history information, because we had information on how fast people would become immunocompromised and progress to AIDS. And he could use that with an outstanding AIDS reporting system. Now, at the time, almost all cases of AIDS were hospitalized, and reporting and active and passive reporting was at least 95% sensitive. He took this information, and in order to get more attention and advocacy at the public health level, because budgets were very, very low, and cases at the time were only reported from still a couple handfuls of states. And at a planning conference attended only by two reporters, two was plenty, and a lot of internal public health service people, he went from 8,000 cases reported and presented this and showed that in the next 5 years in the Reagan administration, there would be 270,000 cases. Our hospitals would start to get filled up with people who were sick, and that this was an inevitable progression based upon the number of people already infected. So the first thing we did was immediately publish this before somebody said we shouldn't, and I think it really did help because, in fact, by 1991, Dr. Morgan was off by about 4,000 cases. So we were hoping that he would be wrong, but it was a chance to demonstrate this. We're fortunate to recruit an infectious disease epidemiologist and state epidemiologist, Dr. Jonathan Mann, to start what became the largest HIV research project in Africa, Projet SIDA, in Kinshasa, Zaire. And Dr. Mann and his colleagues from NIH, the Institute of Tropical Medicine, and particularly Dr. Bila Kapita from Mamiyemo Hospital in Kinshasa, published some of the first papers at the first International AIDS Conference that were presented. And he showed that in Kinshasa, Zaire, which is thought of as one of the early seats of the AIDS epidemic, that the incidence of AIDS was 50 times higher than in the United States and 15 times higher than it would ever be in any city in the United States. And this is in 1984. It's a picture of the Projet SIDA team, one of the people who got us started there was Dr. Joe McCormick on the left, Dr. John Mann, Dr. Enzila, Dr. Skip Francis, who was the NIH assignee, Peter Piot in the back, Dr. Capita, who was the head of medicine at Mami Emo Hospital, a younger Jim Curran, Tom Quinn, and Nelson. Peter Piot's there. Joseph Perienz is the other one. Dr. Ngali, who was mysteriously killed in Zaire, and Dr. Robin Ryder, who succeeded him. So what are the lessons? Well, the first lesson is what we used to say when people would say, why don't you treat AIDS like other STDs? We would say, AIDS stands for AIDS is different, stupid. Now, why did we say that? Because it was true? Not necessarily. We said it because many people were saying, we would like this to be treated like we did STDs in the interlude. We'd like you to ignore it. We'd like you to do contact tracing largely. We'd like you to quit dealing with the community. Who cares what the gay community thinks? We'd like you to pay less attention to this problem. So AIDS was not only different from STDs, but we said AIDS is also different from other chronic diseases. It can't be shoved back in the closet. And the reason we said it was different is because the biologic and social factors favor this insidious spread, this community incubation period, and long-term endemicity. The first one, of course, is the long period between infection, symptomatic illness, and death. That occurs both in an individual with silent infection and silent infectivity. The vast majority of infections in the world occur from people who don't know they have it to other people who don't know they have it. We know there are 35 million people with HIV in the world, but they don't know. And in a community, the prevalence greatly exceeds the incidence for an insidious epidemic. HIV persists for the life of the human host, a pretty bad iceberg. It's highly stigmatizing. You guys, of course, know stigma. And you know that the modes of transmission, sex, and drugs are the reason for it. I've been in hundreds of communities and in many countries when people say, you know, in my culture, it's very difficult to talk about sex. And I said, well, I was talking to Rick Santorum the other day. And it's real easy to talk about sex in our country. People don't hate gays the way they used to when I was in high school and when I started STDs, but they still don't feel comfortable around gay people. Not everybody. A lot of people don't. You'll do okay at this meeting, and you'll do okay in Minnesota, but homophobia is alive and well, as is racism and sexism. And I've even run into racist gay men who hate drug addicts. Drug addicts are despicable people, aren't they? Not really. They're just like you and me. And, of course, people are afraid of sick people. And the high case fatality rate makes it very uncomfortable to be around people who look like they're dying, who have diarrhea, who are sick and hopeless. And then people were afraid of getting it. I can remember a young physician from New York who was the first person in his family to go to college, who came to see me in Atlanta on his way back to Columbus, Ohio, and he'd had pneumocystis, and he wanted to know if I knew a place to live because his parents told him not to come home because he was afraid he'd give it to his kids. Star in his class at NYU Medical School. And, of course, HIV preferentially affects the poor, and the poor have competing priorities, like they'd like to have a job and eat and find a place to live, and they have other problems, and we have competing priorities for them. Right now, AIDS is a priority globally, but we may shift our priorities and decide that we're going to help the poor some other way. And I'm reminded, of course, that the poor don't vote as often as the non-poor. Status of women in most societies. In the very best of societies, women have less power than men. And in many societies, they lack sexual power. Lack sexual control. And that's an important factor. And HIV attacks the immune system. Think of 35 to 40 million human incubators around the world who don't know they're infected, who might have some new organism or some new version of an old organism. And, of course, the most remarkable example is tuberculosis, but also pneumococcal pneumonia and others greatly increase morbidity. And it enhances the effects of poverty-related conditions. And by this, I guess I mean, let's take breastfeeding. In 1985, the CDC strongly recommended that women with HIV not breastfeed in the United States. That still is something which cannot be accomplished in sub-Saharan Africa due to the perils of non-breastfeeding, strictly related to the poverty of the continent. And of course, there's still no vaccine or curative therapy. But what I'd like to say today is that there's another lesson, and that is AINDS, which is AIDS is not different, stupid. And that many of the HIV lessons also apply to prevention of STDs and also other illnesses. Now, I don't want to just talk about the obvious things. Most of these are also sexually transmitted, as is HIV. Many of the high-risk populations are at high risk for both. Using condoms, reducing concurrent partnerships are effective for all. Even circumcision can decrease HIV and general ulcer disease and perhaps others. But I want to talk about other lessons for HIV, STD, and chronic diseases. First of all, sometimes we forget that causality is crucial for primary prevention. It's not really enough to just tell people, don't have as much sex, it doesn't matter why, but just don't do it. That you could tell I've been talking to Rick Santorum lately again. You've got to have a reason, and the reason's got to be related to cause, and the cause can lead to more specific prevention. HCV is now most of non-A, non-B hepatitis, and cervical cancer is now known to be caused by HPV, and there can be a vaccine. But also we know that knowing the specific bacteriologic cause or microbiologic cause may not be enough, that there are other social determinants that play in. And that some of these organisms, like HIV, HCV, HBV, are transmitted in other ways in addition to sex. Surveillance is crucial. It was certainly critical in the early years of the AIDS epidemic, but excellent surveillance costs a lot of money. CDC is still struggling with trying to determine HIV incidence, which is an elusive type thing to do. And using surveillance to evaluate programs for infrequent conditions is very, very difficult. But excellent surveillance can cause attention to problems and can garner and target resources. And if we had better surveillance, for example, for hepatitis C and other conditions, which I think are undervalued, we'd be better off. It's hard for us to remember that prevention needs to be linked to care whenever possible. And when we talk about HIV prevention, we forget that what the people care about the most is care. In the old days, I had ACT UP linking themselves to my offices, saying, you're not relevant, all we care about is care. But after all, when you're dying, what's more important? And that's what dominates the landscape when it comes to HIV. Now, that was known in the old days for STD treatment, although the community wasn't always involved. And fortunately, diagnosis and treatment can often decrease or eliminate transmission, as it can do with HIV, certainly does with syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. And that secondary prevention can prevent morbidity and mortality, as with AIDS, but also with pelvic inflammatory disease, and perhaps even with cirrhosis. The problem is that care itself can dominate the landscape so much that prevention gets short shrift. And also, prevention programs have different priority populations. So treatment is prevention isn't going to, for example, try to find high-risk transmitters for HIV. It's going to be forced to be dealing with the people who come in for care, who are the sickest, who may or may not be the most important transmitters. And of course, that's important, but it isn't necessarily how you would design even a prevention treatment as prevention program. Now, the other thing is that we are always still trying to find the magic bullet, ever since Paul Ehrlich and others. And actually, in AIDS, we want to find the next bullet. So we have condoms. We've had condoms. We've had diagnosis and testing for positives. And we then were trying to find microbicides, and now we found treatment is prevention. But we have to remember that in randomized clinical trials, efficacy does not mean effectiveness in larger populations, and effectiveness doesn't even mean scalability for program impact. So it's likely we're going to need all of these approaches to be most have the most impact. And here's an example many people have shown before. This one's from Friedman, and it's a chart provided by Peter Kilmarks of CDC. And it basically is an example of, in the United States, for every 100 people with HIV, only 80% are aware of their status. And the CDC has estimated that the 20% who don't know their status are responsible for 50 to 60% of the infections. So you got one big limiting factor there, that the people who don't know their status are transmitting half of the infections. But then those who know their status, only 70% are linked to care, only 60% of them are retained in care, only 80% of them are on antiretrovirals, and Kilmarks at the time only estimated that 20% overall are virally suppressed. So for the 100 people, only 20% are virally suppressed in a country with widespread health care and with a Ryan White program that deals with many of the uninsured and provides care through ADAP programs. So it's going to be hard for viral suppression in and of itself without an awful lot of help to get this cascade forward to have the kind of impact we want. Now, I'm guessing what happens to most of these people in the cascade is as they get sicker, they move it to the bottom, because the mortality rate is much more than 20% of what it used to be. So I think the people are telling us when they're not sick that they drop out of the cascade. Now, some of them still die, and a lot of those people are still in the people who aren't diagnosed. So there's still need for behavioral and social scientists to work with us. So I wanted to find out how many there are now at CDC. So I called Dr. Sevkir Rao, and I said, how many behavioral and social scientists that are doctorally trained are now at the CDC compared to the two when you were hired? And she said, I don't know. Did that sound like her? And I said, Sevki, that's no excuse. You're a high-ranking official at the CDC. You should know these things. So she waited a little while, and she said, between 700 and 800. So she came up with the answer. I called her Sevki as a personal thing. 700 to 800 is a recognition in public health with the temporal association of the AIDS epidemic that shows that we need to involve multidisciplinary scientists. Another lesson is that primary prevention works, but clinicians and policymakers are skeptical. Of course, what changed the syphilis epidemic in the United States in gay men was the AIDS epidemic. It went to almost no cases in gay men during the early years of the AIDS epidemic. Behavior can change. Behavior changes. Attributing it to programmatic efforts may be a problem, but behavior can change. But in general, we clinicians don't believe in prevention. I can remember in my STD days, people used a word called recidivist for the people that used to come back to the VD clinics. These people never use condoms. We didn't even give out condoms in clinics. We just saw these people coming back, you know. I mean, that's, of course, the clinician's bias. You only take care of the people who come back. You don't take care of the people who don't come back for whom prevention works. And there have always been very poor links between public health and clinical medicine, and they're endangered even more. And, of course, behavior change doesn't always work. It is not uniformly successful. There are people who will not change their behavior. The other thing that's happened is that it's important to work closely with communities affected by morbidity and mortality. Successes, I think, are in the HIV community, the breast cancer community. Can this happen in other areas? One of the problems we have in public health is our prevention programs are not aimed at the people who are suffering. So, for example, we're not going to get a group of smokers together and say, why don't you have ACT UP against smoking? And we're not going to get obese people to try to not be obese. What we're trying to do is prevent heart disease and lung cancer. These are the people that are our partners in prevention. It's the people who are suffering. It's not the people who are risk factor people. Again, with Rick Santorum, we're not against sex. We're against disease. We're against the problems. And we need to get the people engaged with us who in their concern. So the gay community in 1970, 1978, they were concerned about hepatitis. They were concerned about enteric infections. They weren't that concerned about syphilis, which is relatively infrequent. Then they became really, really, really concerned about AIDS. And now you might say that, as many people in the conferences say, that healthy sexuality is more than the absence of infections. So where do we as a group stand with gay marriage, something which I think is very important for healthy sexuality, or reproductive choices? You don't have to advocate for these things, but you ought to know where you stand, and you ought to know how where you stand sits with the communities that you're working with. Don't be surprised when they say, "We got married," and if you frown at them, they won't come back. And then, of course, most public health problems disproportionately affect the poor. And then I want to remind us of Tuskegee and Guatemala as lessons of how we don't work with communities and that would stay with us. Finally, of course, people make the difference, and you are the people. People who are dedicated, who are science-based, who are collegial, working together with communities, people who work with people with AIDS, who work with other leaders in the AIDS community. It's been Magic Johnson, it's been Arthur Ashe, it's been Bono, it's been courageous people in government and non-governmental organizations. It's been thousands and thousands of people who've died of AIDS but advocated for it. And it's been people like you who work together to make a real difference. Now, my friend Dr. Jonathan Mann and his wife, Mary Lou Clements Mann, an AIDS vaccine researcher, went on to found the Global Program on AIDS at the World Health Organization. And he was the first person to link the fight against AIDS to the fight for social justice. Unfortunately, he and his wife died in a Swiss air crash on the way back to WHO, perhaps to take a leadership position at that agency. He had worked at Harvard in the interim before that, and he'd given a speech that year at the 12th International Conference on AIDS in Geneva. And that was the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And Dr. Mann said the following: "Our responsibility is historic, for when the history of AIDS and the global response is written, our most precious contribution may well be that at a time of plague, we did not flee, we did not hide, and we did not separate ourselves." So work together across boundaries, work with other public health people, work with people in the community, work with scientists to do the very best you can, and never, never, never give up.
So we may have time for a few questions before we move on to the reception, but I would like to start with one, Jim, because you've been sort of in the history of when STD was VD and we focused on sexually transmitted infections. HIV came along. HIV originally was in the STD programs. For all the reasons you outlined, it moved into the HIV program world. And I think that for those of us working in STD prevention who are working well together as people, trying to use our science-based approaches, using our resources well, I think our challenge is we don't have that level of advocacy, we don't have that level of community support, and I think we are recognizing that STD does play a role in HIV prevention. The table has sort of turned. But I think a lot of STD programs are really struggling to find out where do we fit now in the equation of public health prevention. So I'm curious if you have some advice for the STD prevention world as to what our role should be and lessons that we can learn from the HIV.
Well, I think that You know, the historical reasons for the growth of AIDS at CDC began with the need for strong laboratory support. And as you know, the laboratories at CDC are separate from that. And much of the leadership of the original AIDS groups came from the STD people. The prevention programs then went to the STD division when they were funded. So they were run out of the STD division. CDC was struggling to try to get as much as it could done with state and local health departments. I think that one of the differences, there are two differences with AIDS in addition to it being fatal. One was the strong clinical, serious clinical aspects of it that involve specialized medicine and hospitalization, and the huge scientific efforts that were going on that are non-health department based. And it began a very strong NGO type of funding at the CDC level. So I think one of the things is to take sort of a sexual health approach and to try to work with health departments in the community and community organizations, and to in the prevention area in particular, work with the HIV folks. I think you know we already have, now we have an HIV industry, of course. There's a huge billions of dollars with HIV going on, but find the areas of commonality to work together, because a lot of the people, some of you are already the same people. I mean, I guess I would say that. I also think that we have a lot in common with the family planning folks. When I started in STDs, family planning and STD people wouldn't talk to each other, and it was largely because, in my remembrance, I mean, King, if you remember that, I think the problem was it's sort of the dual stigma. They both had to deal with their own problems. STD clinics saw mostly men. A family planning clinic saw all women, and they didn't want to bother with each other's problems. And so, therefore, it was very hard to integrate these things. This is not what sexual health is about. And if you want to get advocacy that ties together, for example, I mean, Planned Parenthood is under siege right now. You know, I mean, my wife and I send them money. A lot of people should be on the board of Planned Parenthood. I mean, we ought to be thinking about who our partners are in public health, and we ought to band together with those people. The problem we sometimes have in public health is we eat each other up. You know, we say, oh, those people have more money than I do. We're both starving, but they have more than I do. So it's important to get together with people in commonalities and work together.
Okay, thank you. Jeff?
Hi. Jim, I'm Jeff Levy from Trust for America's Health. And Jim, thank you for a wonderful talk.
I knew your father.
And I'm sort of angry that 30 years later you have as much hair on your head as you did in 1981. What can I say? A few points. One, in the scheme of things, relatively small, but I think important, which is, you know, in talking about the cascade of people with HIV who don't know their status, I totally agree with you that we have to be thinking about behavioral approaches, and we have to be thinking about what happens outside the clinic. But there's more and more convincing data that what within the four walls of the clinic, people aren't doing their job. That so many of the people who are diagnosed had contact with the healthcare system in the previous 12 months, and there were missed opportunities to test and screen. That relates back to stigma, attitudes, assumptions, all sorts of other things. But that's, and some of it is money, but the reimbursement is there. That's tomorrow's talk. But I think it's important to recognize that that's a failure, and it is not necessarily, and that there is a continued and growing role for diagnosis within the clinical system. I'd like to disagree with you slightly in your comment about, you know, people in public health need to know where they stand on things like gay marriage and be comfortable with conversations about it, but they don't necessarily need to advocate for it. It's a part of addressing the social determinants of health, and it's a part of making sure that we live in a context where people can be sexually healthy. And if it is left to the community and those who are affected by it to advocate on behalf of those social determinants, then it will never gain the credibility it needs to have if scientists and public health people are joining in that conversation. And I guess the last thing I want to say, which is a little bit trickier, is that as we start thinking about social determinants, we have to get out of some of the disease, obviously out of some of the disease categories, and even out of an infectious disease versus chronic disease versus whatever disease mindset. If I were to reorganize the CDC today, I'd probably create a center on community prevention and a center on clinical prevention and make sure there were dotted lines across the two, and not necessarily distinguish by disease, because what you need to be doing people don't think about their lives and their health one disease at a time, and the responses and the determinants of that health also don't fall into neat disease categories. And I think while PICSI is a wonderful thing and needs to happen, and thinking more broadly about social determinants of things like STDs is very important, we also need to think in the larger context, because that's ultimately where we're going to succeed.
If I didn't think it would go to your head, I would give you a round of applause for your outstanding leadership in AIDS and public health for the last three decades. So I'd like to do it anyway. Even though you were sometimes a pain in the ass, I always loved you. And I think I also would applaud more loudly than the audience did about your view on gay marriage. And I myself am an advocate for gay marriage rights. But I want to tell you why I said what I did. And I would say the same thing about pro-choice and pro-life. The truth is that a large number of people, including our president, who hasn't said he's for gay marriage, a large number of people don't feel that way. And a number of those people work in STD programs and public health departments and other places. And I want them to keep working. I mean, I don't want them to be homophobic, but how they feel particularly about gay marriage shouldn't be a litmus test. And the other part of it is I want them to know how they feel so that they can deal with that and see if they should continue to work in this area and not be surprised by it or not make some disparaging remarks to somebody who they may not even know is gay. And the same thing with abortion. I think if you're working in a family planning clinic, you need to, maybe it is a litmus test. But if you're working in an STD clinic, being pro-choice or pro-life doesn't have to be a litmus test. And there's probably a number of people in this room who have differing opinions on this. And I think that they can still contribute a lot. The other thing you said is, and this is just a warning from an old government bureaucrat, as soon as you start organizing things that way, there's two risks. First risk is a big block grant, which gets cut by 20% each year, and there's no funding for anything. And that often happens. I mean, community prevention sounds like a block grant. Clinical prevention sounds like a block grant. So not only do you not target STDs and HIV, but, I mean, you know, gay men are just 5-10% of the population. Why should there be any priority there? Why should there be priority by anything? Let the communities decide what their priorities are and then cut them into a block grant. So I'm kind of an old categorical guy, and I think some of the categories maybe should be merged. But we got to remember where we were with funding during the interlude and where we are with funding now. And how those things, I think, need to be maintained and expanded.
Anyway, we're running out of time. So one is I want to thank everyone, and I especially want to thank Dr. Kern for your insightful comments for us to continue working on.